Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm thrilled to have as my guest Louise Erdrich. Her most recent book, published by HarperCollins, is The Last Report on the Miracles at Little No Horse. She is the author, as well, of Love Medicine, The Beat Queen, Tracks, The Bingo Palace, Tales of Burning Love, and The Antelope Wife. She is the author of two books of poetry, a book about infancy called The Blue Jay's Dance, nonfiction. And this is the most recent in the cycle about Little No Horse. Now, you talk about how the book began with two images that came to you in dreams. And I wanted in particular to talk to you about dreaming and writing.
Oh, good. It's a subject I can get into.
What were the images, first of all?
Well, the images were one of a woman in a billowing white nightdress on the lid of a black grand piano, swirling off into a flood. And the other was the image of a priest. Well, it occurred in the writing. I was writing about a priest who has, for many, many years, written letters to the Pope and has had these letters unanswered. And I had this elderly priest writing late at night and then getting up, slowly removing clothing in order to go to bed. And this priest, as he unwound an ace bandage from around his chest, turned out to be a woman. And I started with these two images, not knowing how they would come together. And it took years for them to somehow make sense with one another.
Now, in a sense, though, in dreams, everything is everything else. A priest can be a woman. That woman can be floating on a flood on top of a piano, a grand piano. It seems to me that many of the connections in the book are, if not inspired by dreams, dreamlike.
I don't actually dream the images, although sometimes I'll have a character or someone who wakes me up in the middle of the night. But I really think of my waking day of writing as part dream, and I think that going in, sometimes I go in and out of sleep even while I'm sitting in my chair, and I figure out a lot of the plot through dream or through a kind of attention to the unconscious that allows me to go places that don't make sense sometimes. On the other hand, a lot of the things that do seem very dreamlike are actually based in very specific bits of research.
In particular, for me, the most dreamlike image, the Father Damien, mm-hmm. has in the past been a nun, Sister Cecilia, and an ordinary woman named Agnes.
Right.
And her house has been flooded. The flood comes through a wall that had been cut out of the house to make way for the piano, to make the it possible for the piano to enter. She floats when the flood comes on the piano, but she crosses a bridge of cows to reach the banks. And it was that bridge of cows that...
Well, it made sense to me, though. It actually, in a report on floods, I came across a fact about a poor herd of cows that had been drowned and who made a dike for a piece of the way. The flood refuse collected against it, and it actually stopped part of the flood. So, you know, these strange images are so often, for me, based in reality. And reality, perhaps the reality that I choose has a dreamlike quality often. But I'm always surprised at how much more incredible reality is than anything that I can invent, and how it draws me. I'm always drawn to the unusual and the marvelous. And that's really what this book is about. It's about whether this saint, this supposed saint, is a saint by virtue of the wonders and the miracles performed in her presence, or whether her sainthood is the result of acts of everyday kindness and ordinary humility and a goodness in a sense that hasn't, you know, that isn't remarkable at all, just an everyday kind of goodness. What is it that makes someone stand out as special and saintly?
In fact, it seems to me that there are two potential saints in the book. Father Damien is one of them, and Sister Leopolda is the other, and they represent the two poles of sainthood, the violence of sainthood on the one hand, and the kind of peaceful tolerance of sainthood on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right in thinking that?
I think exactly, that's exactly true. And the person who investigates the entire situation eventually comes to believe that he has been searching out the details of the life of the wrong saint, and that indeed this quiet Father Damien, whose life has not been remarked by anyone outside of his small flock of parishioners, is by contrast the more devout. And just as he decides that this is the case, of course, Father Damien disappears from his life. So he's forced to reinvestigate another saint by the end of the book.
I'm speaking to Louise Erdrich on the occasion of the publication of her really miraculous book, The Last Report on the Miracles at Little No Horse. You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I wanted to talk about time, not just in this book, but in the series of books. And I wondered if you would do me a favor and read the, what is that?
I'll read this word. And it's a dedication. I didn't make that clear. But I wanted to dedicate this book to Nindinawe Maganiduk. And Nindinawe Maganiduk is a very special Ojibwe word. It means my relatives. But I'll read this piece. There are four layers above the earth and four layers below. Sometimes in our dreams and creations, we pass through the layers, which are also space and time. In saying the word Nindinawe Maganiduk, or my relatives, we speak of everything that has existed in time, the known and the unknown, the unseen, the obvious, all that lived before or is living now in the worlds above and below. So, in dedicating the book to Nindinawe Maganiduk, it really encompasses more than I can really describe. And I say that word without really understanding yet how to grasp the all-inclusiveness of the word. I think you have to be a born speaker of the language, and therefore a person who understands the Ojibwe outlook to really grasp what that word means, because it means virtually everything. And it's probably what I'm still searching to understand throughout every book.
What interested me about it was that as I read this book, I thought of events in all of the others so that I was experiencing a realm in which there were four levels above and below the earth. And I found myself thinking how marvelous it is for a book to call upon its own ancestor books in the course of its composition. Now, in the afterword of the book, you suggest, I think playfully, that some of the transcribed confessions from Father Damien's papers have appeared on your desk and that you don't remember having written them.
Yeah. Well, when I started the book, I had this elderly cleric, and, you know, I realized that all of the books, practically all of them, have been first-person confessions, first-person narratives. And truly, there is a quality of disbelief sometimes. When I finish a long piece of writing in someone else's voice and the person has had experiences that I couldn't possibly have made up, and sometimes I feel, where did this come from? I don't understand. Is there some sort of collective unconscious? What am I tapping into? Where is this from? And so I began the book thinking, well, here's the explanation. There's this elderly priest who has been writing to the Vatican and telling the Pope all of the things he's heard in the confession. So again, it's another level of invention, and yet it was a way of sort of passing the buck on to this priest for me.
But do you have any ideas about where the imagination arrives from?
I really do. I think there is some well of unconscious, like a deep pool of water, and I don't know what swims there, and I don't know when I can even gain access to it. It's not under my control, but there are times when I give special and quiet and close attention to the possibilities, and somehow I'm able to enter, and I'm given some character or some story or some piece of information that I can't possibly have come up with on my own.
Do you think it's in the realm of Jungian archetypes, or what is the way? I assume that you're a folklorist in some
ways. I certainly am, and I collect bits of information, as I've said, and bits of stories. And of course, I grew up in a family where stories were part of everyday conversation, and everything could be a story and was made into a story. And that's both the German and the Ojibwe sides of my family. Mainly people were very funny, though, and ironic. But I don't know how to respond to it being Jungian, because I also think in Ojibwe philosophy, it's accepted as a given that there is a connection between peoples, and that there is a common ground of symbolism, and that it is a matter that you go there as a matter of course, and that your dreams connect you with other human being and human experiences and people from the past. It isn't a strange thing. I think people who pay very close attention to their natural surroundings and their natural world and rely upon the quality of that attention for survival are tuned into what might seem to people outside that culture to be a fantastic array of understandings, and that these understandings may take on the form of archetypes and may seem, to be incredible, but really are based in eating and sleeping and surviving. And, that knowing the sacred is part of knowing the ordinary for a people who has who managed to survive and to keep their world intact for, millennia before the Europeans arrived on this continent.
Did the German and the Ojibwe sides of your family tell each other stories, and did their stories influence each other?
Very much so. And I think in the first books there's, there's German fairy tales that kind of blend into the Ojibwe culture figures. And I I have a very close relationship with my dad, and he's a very funny man, and we cultivate this kind of German eccentricity that people don't hear a lot about. There's much more of the, you know, German punctuality and German efficiency that people probably associate with being Deutsch. But my dad's really unusual and unusually well-read and unusual in the sense that he collects stories the way other people, you know, might collect stamps. Or he collects stamps, too. Or whatever they collect. But he has a gift for that.
These books are, in their way, as well as being novels, they are collections of stories as well. And often is not, the forward progress of an ongoing narrative will be interrupted for a story.
Mm-hmm.
And stories seem to act as transactions,
mm-hmm.
so that people can achieve symbolically the thing that they are hard put to achieve in actuality.
Right, right. And that's very much out of the oral Ojibwe tradition. The stories that are told during a winter cycle begin and then are put aside, and the story takes off in another direction and comes around and picks up where the other story left off.
When did the stories begin to be collected?
Well, I started writing this book in the late 80s, 88 or 89. I was looking back through my notes, and I think I had written the title down in 88. I always write into a title as though it's a basket or a container. And I always have the title for many, many years before I collect the book into it. In fact, I use notebooks and boxes, and I throw the notes in, and I keep the bits and pieces that I acquire that are going to go into the book all together, and sometimes in cigar boxes and sometimes in larger boxes, but they're collages.
Was this the longest composition for any one book?
I don't think so. I think they all take about, I think Tracks was begun well before Love Medicine ever appeared. And I have bits and pieces of books that I started before Love Medicine. So they're all this, sometimes they leapfrog one another, but they're all part of what I see as one long complicated narrative.
Now, this book involves the keeping of secrets,
yes,
for many years, and it's something that I'm personally very interested in. I wondered, this figure who lives at a slight distance from others because of a self-knowledge that, mm-hmm. he, she will not share. Can you comment about a life like that?
This person, you're talking about Father Damien, who lives, who is Agnes, who lives out her life as a man, becomes in many ways an observer of all that's around him or her, and is unable, except in one very unusual circumstance, to really become tremendously close to another human for fear of being discovered. But besides this one other priest she becomes close to, there's also Nanapush, the elderly trickster figure, who has in fact accepted the fact that she is posing as a man, accepted the disguise, because Nanapush feels it's really no stranger than many other things that the European or the Chaganash people do. And so she's surprised to find that part of her disguise has been known and accepted for many years.
But what I noticed about this character is that she keeps her enormous secrets in order to be more truthful. It removes her from the actual, participating in the actual world, as secrets frequently do, but she's not essentially a liar. In fact, she's a truth seeker.
Exactly. She says that becoming a priest is the truest lie she's ever told. And it is because she really feels she hasn't a choice in this matter. And I suppose that may be something of a political comment in that as a woman, she has no choice. She has to become a priest, and she has to be disguised in order to do it. But for her, at first she thinks, I'm really stealing from people. I'm really a lie. I'm at all times. Until she understands more deeply, and she understands at that point that in making this choice about herself, she has simply bent herself to the shape of what's possible, and in that act, she's made great sacrifices.
It fascinated me to learn that you've recently had another daughter, and it seemed to me that at a certain point of life, many people begin to take their gender for granted or move beyond it, forget about their gender.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, what a reminder when writing a book about multi-genders to have to have a child in the middle of life. And I wondered, did that
happen?
Yes,
I'm 46, I should say. Yeah.
But is there a connection between this figure of the man-woman, the aged mm-hmm. man-woman, who would normally be past reproduction, has removed, and there you are with a renewal of that capacity. I mean, it seemed to me to be such an interesting book to be writing while having a child late in life.
It is an odd connection. I keep thinking of that Isaac Dinesen phrase in Seven Gothic Tales where she says, a woman who is done with the business of being a woman must be the most powerful figure on the earth. There's this wonderful piece. And yet I've not done with the business of being a woman, obviously. But I don't know that it had to do so much with, prolonging my sense of myself as a mother, as with a simple wish, and there's really no explanation in that I can come up with intellectually for why I would have a baby. It's all coming from the limbic brain or the mammalian part of who I am, and I have to admit that there's. That's quite a large part of me. I think the neocortical part is shrinking by the day.
but Father Damien is done with the business of being a woman,
right,
and has been
right.
done with it for some time. What's marvelous about this figure is that there has been a period of enormous passion
mm-hmm.
in her life.
Mm-hmm.
This is not someone who is fulfilling any kind of cliché of the disappearance into spirituality.
No,
She's known both the passion of physical love and the passion of music and the passion of Christ. She's been given every passion.
Yes.
And now she is in a neutered but very powerful wisdom relationship to her past and the presence of the people around her.
I think that one of the best pieces of, I wouldn't call it research, it was just a word search that I found in reading through an old Catholic dictionary was that the word passion is the word for story, and it's the Catholic word for story. As we know, the passion of Christ is the story of Christ. And in her remove from life. She reaches the point in life where she sees all that lies before her. She can see that the passion that gripped her in the moment and that caused her to act with an almost with a directness beyond understanding, that those passions were just part of a larger passion, which is the story of what she's come through and the story of who she is.
A final question. It seems to me that these books become more and more about a meeting point of Ojibwe tradition and Catholic tradition, of German and Ojibwe, of all male and female, mm-hmm. that all of the disparate oppositions are meeting in, I don't know how exactly to put it, as if there were to be a concept for the thought of these books of being proudly mixed blood, mm-hmm. that the subjects of the book become an exploration of mixture.
I think it's encompassed in that word, Nindinawe Maganidok, somehow. And it is what I'm still exploring. I don't think these books are an explanation of the mixed blood universe or of the Ojibwe French-German universe, but they are an exploration of what it means to be of mixed identity in a world of increasing mixed identity and in a world where everyone is Nintinawe Maganidok, where we're all related.
What is mixed identity as opposed to mixed blood?
I think it's the same. You know, I think when you're talking about someone who's of mixed background, inevitably there's a question of identity and there's a question of allegiance to one particular strain of blood or another. In many cases, some people it makes no difference. And some people hold on to these pieces of identity very fiercely.
In fact, one of the things I love about Father Damien is that her memory arrives in the form of islands. She remembers moments or glimpses of things, and then they retreat. Mm-hmm. And she's lived so many lives, in a sense, that it's almost as if the idea of coherent identity is a kind of joke.
It is a kind of joke anyway, isn't it?
It seems to me.
I mean, as we are collections of whatever scraps of minerals and materials, we're also collections of whatever genetic bits and pieces have floated into this collision that we call the self.
I've been speaking to Louise Erdrich on the occasion of the publication by HarperCollins of the last report on the miracles at Little No Horse. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.